introduction. I'm Larry Kay, and I am a recovered compulsive overeater. And I'm presently down in Phoenix, Arizona, but I'm originally from Chicago area and from the Chicago area. And so I'm really delighted to be here. And I'm so glad that you're joining us this morning. And thanks for all the, it takes a village, right, to put these things on. And just a tremendous amount of effort. These things don't just come together. This takes a tremendous amount of effort from a lot of people. So you know all who you are. So thank you so much. You're helping so many people, and you offer tremendous hope to all of us. You know, we're talking about hope, and I didn't feel a whole lot of hope when I arrived to Overeaters Anonymous quite a number of years ago. And as was mentioned, I was about 100 pounds heavier than I am today. But I probably was a bit more, but I don't know about you, but I stopped weighing myself at a certain point. And I did not get to the rooms with a whole lot of hope. In fact, I know there's probably someone on the line that is either eating now or ate last night or will be eating later today, you know? And so what hope does that person feel? And yet you're here. You know, you're here. There's something. See, I believe there's something sacred. There's some sort of divine, a divine phenomena that is the very reason that you're here this morning. Now, there's nothing that I will say. There's no magic to this. This disease that I have of compulsive overeating, but really what I have is an alcoholic mind. It's like whack-a-mole. Food absolutely would have taken me out, but I have to tell you, there are other substances, there are other behaviors that I've been confronted with. I'll speak about some of those things. This disease truly for me, I didn't know what I was up against. I had no idea when I arrived here. I mentioned that I'm a clinical psychologist only because, not to impress anyone, I'm not impressed. I don't know about you, but I'm not all that impressed. But I mentioned that to you because, you know, there are people, this disease does not discriminate. There are people, I have a friend down here that arrived to the rooms with a very low physical bottom. He was once 700 pounds, you know, and that man lives and walks and breathes. And I know other people that arrived here with the very same disease. And they arrived to the rooms and I saw them, you see them. They may be 100 pounds dripping wet. And you think to yourself, what rights, you know, does that person have? What, you know, why is that person here? I was at a meeting yesterday. There was such a person, a face-to-face meeting. I've had my vaccination, you guys. I'm safe, so you don't have to wear any masks. I think I'm relatively safe. However, what I will tell you is, the disease does not discriminate. We share something. We share, and I had to learn about what we share. And it took a while. I'd love to tell you that I came to the rooms, you know, and I just put the food down from day one. And I just kept coming back like you told me. And you told me to, you know, you told me to wait for the miracle to happen. And I sat on my butt and I waited. And I waited. Now, I could diet with the best of them. I bet you can as well. Most of us on the line, we know how to diet, right? We can stop. We're not helpless. Problem is, I don't know about you, but I couldn't stay stopped. The other shoe was always waiting to drop, and it always did for me. And yet I waited, and I waited, and I waited in the rooms of Overeaters Anonymous with this fancy schmancy degree, you know, all this synthetic knowledge that suggested that I knew what I was up against and that this was somehow going to be some sort of, you know, the first meeting I went to, it really, first of all, I was the only guy in the room. And there were, I believe, about 12 or 13 women. Some were thin, some were heavy, but they spoke the language of the heart. I couldn't tell who was on a recovery trajectory, who wasn't. But they spoke in a way, they offered, I'll tell you the hope they offered. They offered that very first meeting, some 20 years ago, the first meeting that I came in the rooms. They spoke about things in a way, what they did with food that I thought were secret unto me, I did not think that these were secrets I was going to take to my grave. They talked about stealing food. They talked about one woman I remember. She talked about putting Ajax on food. You ever done that? I don't know there was Ajax, but I put something on food because, of course, I'm not going to touch it. Well, it's amazing how you can wipe things off. I could take food out. They were talking about taking food out of the garbage. They were talking about eating burnt food, stealing food, as I say. All these things that I had done, and it was like jaw-dropping. They knew me. Now, as I say, I'd love to tell you, and it did offer some hope. Because as I say, someone on this line is eating perhaps right now or ate this morning, and you have nothing to be ashamed of. You have nothing to be ashamed of. You have a disease. The disease can be quite complex, particularly with food. It can be quite complex. You know, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is one piece of literature. Roseanne, she certainly was told, Roseanne, you know the history. We had a woman right out of Milwaukee there that was a great mentor to me from a distance that is no longer with us. But she knew the first time that I spoke in Milwaukee was a number of years ago. And I was just sharing, you know, that about this spiritual program of action and then how the message has over time been watered down. And she agreed and she fought very hard so that the message, the spiritual message, a practical program of action would be something, because that would be ultimately the hope that's offered. There's no hope in coming to the rooms and not taking action and waiting for the miracle to happen, waiting. I was waiting for the pixie dust. You know the pixie dust? You remember Veruca, the character from Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory? Remember her? That was how I worked the program in this sense. She would sing, you know, Daddy, I want an Oompa Loompa. I want an Oompa Loompa. And I want it now, Daddy. I want the whole world, right? Now, we've just lost a bunch of people because I'm going into singing here, which I should do. But the point was, is she want, and that's what I wanted. I wanted this and I wanted it now. I didn't want it later. And I figured that it would be time served in the rooms and that you would teach me how to diet. You would give me a food plan. And somehow through group support, I could diet with group support for the rest of my life and fight my way and hold my breath underwater for one more day. Eventually, I would always come up for air. You know that. You hear me. I see you. You know what I'm talking about. Holding your breath underwater. Working a program of tools. If you tell me to make 3 phone calls a day, call my sponsor at 3:30 in the morning, I'll be right on time. You tell me to read literature, I'll do that. No one ever told me that I had a spiritual malady. At least I didn't hear it right away. And that somehow, it didn't pass the smell test for me, quite frankly. The idea that, no, wait a minute. Is this what you're telling me? This is the hope you're offering me. You're telling me that I will not want those foods when I complete this program of action, following the instructions precisely. Not perfectly, right? Because you can't do it perfectly, right? Because no human being can work the steps perfectly. But that I was not helpless. I was powerless. So you told me that in the first step, but I was not helpless. And if someone was going to put the food down, if I was waiting for someone to put the food down on my behalf, I probably will die in the process eventually. But that I was not helpless. I would have to put the food down and trust in the process, right? Now you're telling me that's the solution, that this obsession to eat these alcoholic food substances would be eradicated? That's what you're telling me? Really? In 2000 and whatever it was, you know, 19, whatever it was when I was here, and that the obsession will be lifted and it will be removed, the problem will be solved. Yet I will still have things will happen in life, like people will die, people will get sick. There will be things like COVID. There will be things that happen in life. And yet you're trying to convince me that if I work the steps, and I do it rather quickly, which made no sense to me, because I'm a therapist. You process things slowly. right? And you're telling me that my hope is that the obsession will be lifted and I will not want those foods and I will be sober, I will be abstinent peacefully in the midst of calamity? That's the hope you're offering me? And I thought that that's not possible. Matter of fact, here's why it's not possible. Because I have not experienced anything like that before. The most I ever got was dieting. And occasionally, if I lost a few pounds, I would feel good about that. Is that what you're talking about? Are you talking about metabolism and resetting the metabolic process and so forth? And then I'll feel better. Is that what this is? No, that I didn't know what I was up against. And I didn't know there was a solution. It says in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, here's the hope. And here's the only hope. It says on page 17, bottom paragraph, it says, the tremendous fact for every one of us is that we've discovered a common solution. Those men and women discovered a common solution. We have a way out, not a way around. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the hope, folks. This is the great news the book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. As a compulsive overeater, you have a spiritual malady. That's what they told me, and I had to trust that that were so. So when I got here, I will tell you that when I did a food history, the very first memory was at age 2.5. I'm 55 years of age. And at 2.5 years old, I remembered that I had I climbed up to the top of the refrigerator, the cabinets. At 2.5, I was a climber. And I climbed and I got down a bottle of baby aspirin. Remember that candy? The orange flavored candy, remember that? And I got that bottle of baby aspirin, and somehow at 2.5, I knew to do that in secret. How I knew that, I just knew what I was doing was wrong somehow. There was no childproof caps back in the day. And I proceeded to eat the entire bottle of baby aspirin. And my mother, I have three siblings. My mother came into the kitchen and shrieked. She was beside herself. They rushed me to the Skokie Valley Hospital, was the name of the hospital, Chicago suburb area. And my stomach was pumped. I don't really remember much about that, but I'm here today. And usually when I tell that story, it may trigger something for someone. They remember doing something similar. It might be something along those lines. And I don't care if I'm speaking in Italy or Milwaukee or anywhere, someone often can identify with that. That's my first memory. Maybe I was born a compulsive reader. You know, the sweet taste of that baby aspirin did something for me that it didn't do for other children, right? It was doing something for me. And it triggered a phenomenon of craving. And when I had one, the more I had, the more I wanted. And the more I wanted, the more I ate. And that cycle was endless, right? Perhaps you've heard that before. And they knew me when they wrote this book because they described it in the doctor's opinion. You know, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells us in the doctor's opinion, you know, if you have this thing, you got this illness, you have this thing, your only chance really of getting better is what the big book describes as having a complete psychic change. Complete psychic change. It's used synonymously with spiritual awakening, spiritual transformation, personality change. It all means the same thing, some sort of internal shift, complete change. And you will not have a complete psychic change in the fellowship of Overeaters Anonymous. Why is that? If that was a surprise to you, why is that? Because the fellowship of Overeaters Anonymous was not designed to produce a complete psychic change in a compulsive overeater. Rather, the fellowship of Overeaters Anonymous was designed as a place that you could come for love and support while you work the practical program of spiritual action, which will enable to you to have a complete psychic change. But that psychic change happens in the program, right? It happens in the program. And the program, I was taught, is in the first 164 pages of a book that we call Alcoholics Anonymous. That I do. I am not here to poo-poo Overeaters Anonymous. I owe my life to Overeaters Anonymous. I love Overeaters Anonymous and all the people I've met. You saved my life. But it's all 12-step programs are predicated on a textbook, which is, and any textbook is meant to be gone through with a teacher, a Sherpa, if you will. We call that person a sponsor. And when you do that, so it's really important that we understand this, that that's where the hope is. And I've talked to people that have been in Overeaters Anonymous for 10 and 20 and 30 years and never got that. And they were within the herd and well-supported and working a program of tools. Keep coming back. Wait for the pixie dust to come down. There is no pixie dust. There's no magic wand. So this morning, you know, I want to touch on that fact that, because I want to be of service to you. And if I'm of service to one person, what I want to tell you is that, you know, the first step, right? The very first steps, 1, 2, and 3, which are often called the preparation steps. What are they preparing you for? Well, they're preparing you for the program of action. They're preparing you for the program of action. If you take a look at the 12 steps and look at them as a sequential model, right? And in other words, you take them in sequence, in order. The first three steps are the preparation steps. The work itself, the actual recovery to get and to stay in spiritual condition for a lifetime, we go through the steps. So someone once gave me the shorthand for the steps. And they said, Larry, steps 1, 2, and 3 will get you right with God or your notion of a higher power. Steps 1, 2, and 3 will get you right with God. Steps 4 through 7 will get you right with yourself. Steps 8 and 9 will get you right with others. And then steps 10, 11, and 12 will keep you right with God, with yourself, and with others. And if you haven't heard that before, that's the simplicity. That's the hope in that. This is not, the 12 steps is not a hobby for me. I play Scrabble. Do you play Scrabble ever? That's a hobby. I see Heidi. Heidi's like, Heidi, you play Scrabble too? I see you, Heidi. You can't hide from me, Heidi. And Heidi was raising her hand. And I play Scrabble. That's a hobby. I do it when I have spare time, once in a while. I don't do this when are you working the program of action? I say this with love and kindness and support. Are you working the steps as kind of a hobby when it fits in so that you can get on with other things? Or is program who you are? Because for me, it's become who I am. It's not a hobby. It's a way of life. And it's the most beautiful, glorious way of life. Even when, yes, people pass away, even when my mother has cancer, even when there is financial insecurities, even when the whack-a-mole nature of this spiritual malady can rear its ugly head in other ways that I did not see coming. I didn't see the other substances. They weren't an issue for me until they became an issue for me. I didn't see the other behaviors as an issue for me. I didn't see spending as an issue for me. It was just the food. I thought food was my problem. And you know, none of those things were my problem. I thought because I was sexually abused as a child, that was my problem. After all, if that happened to you, once you say, yeah, well, if we connect the dots, Larry, certainly that's why you eat. Or you were neglected perhaps in certain ways as a child. That's why you eat. Or you were divorced. That's why you eat. Or fill in the blank. None of those reasons are why I ate. You know why I ate? Because I have an allergy of the body and I have a twist of the mind, an obsession of the mind. The doctor's opinion talks about that. The allergy of the body is so simple. It just says this. And if you haven't heard this explanation before, see if this resonates with you. When a normal person picks up food, any type of food whatsoever, they may overindulge, they may be in a heavier body, but every time they eat, at a reasonable point of time, their desire for more goes away, and then they become disinterested in their food. You ever meet these people? They can have a plate of food in front of them, and that is the celebrity in the room for me, right? But they want to tell you a conversation. They've got a steaming plate of French fries or something in front of them, and they put it to the side to tell you a story. What crazy person does that? Not a compulsive overeater. Because when I pick up the substance, my desire for more does not become satisfied. My desire for more becomes intensified. It becomes magnified. And that is not physically normal, right? That's called it's a physiological thing. I pick up a cookie and my desire for more, or pick up three cookies or five cookies and my desire for more does not become satisfied. It becomes intensified. It's not physically normal. And that, I wish that was our only problem, the allergy of the body. But that's not my biggest problem. My biggest problem actually is the second of the twofold nature of the disease, the twist of the mind, they refer to it, or the obsession of the mind. And that says that even when I put the food down, maybe it's not in my system. I've gone on a diet. I've put all of my alcoholic heroin food substances down. I'm losing some weight. It's not coursing through my veins. It's not triggering that physiological allergy, that abnormal physical reaction, right? But because I have that twist in the mind, there will come a day. It may be a beautiful, wonderful day. It may be a lousy day, doesn't have any rhyme or reason to it. The big book talks about that, right? But for some reason, I pick up the food again, thereby triggering the allergy, and I'm off and running. And that cycle of I can't stop once I've started because of the allergy, and I can't stop from starting because of the twist of the mind. So if I can't stop once I've started because of the allergy, and I can't stop from starting because of the twist of the mind, that, ladies and gentlemen, means I am powerless. You are powerless. You do not have the power to stay stopped. That's the first step. The unmanageability, you know, for me, what do you mean I'm unmanageable? I have a PhD. I have a roof over my head. I have a good job. What do you mean? What's this unmanageability stuff? I later learned just how unmanageable my life was. And because the disease is progressive, I kept repeating that cycle over and over again. I want to tell you about my daughter, Elizabeth. My daughter, Elizabeth, is now 25. I have one child. Thank goodness to this program, by the way. I came in when she was a very little girl. She doesn't remember that guy. Her mom does. But I have a good relationship with my ex-wife all these many years. But I want to talk about Elizabeth because Elizabeth has an allergy. Now, she doesn't have our allergy. Elizabeth has an allergy. She has an abnormal physical reaction to peanuts. Anybody on the line know of someone that has an allergy to, like a food allergy? Donna, I see you. Donna knows. Donna H has, just like me, right? And Beth has a peanut allergy. Now, here's the physical manifestation of Beth's peanut allergy. Throat constriction. It's a physiological thing. Beth picks up peanuts, even if she's accidentally exposed, which is probably what would happen. Her throat closes up to the size of a pinhole. And she will die. And it's happened twice. But there's a miracle drug, epinephrine, that will instantly, almost instantly, take care of that. Now, Beth only has one component of two. She has a physical allergy. And most people do not have a peanut allergy. There's why she has an abnormal physical reaction. Perhaps 9.9 people out of 10 do not have that physical allergy. But here's the good news. Beth doesn't have the second, far more insidious component of that disease. We call that the obsession of the mind. And that's why Beth doesn't, she's not driven back to the peanuts. If she was accidentally exposed to peanuts and her throat closes up to the size of a pinhole, she receives immediate treatment with epinephrine, like an EpiPen, right? And she's back to normal. And the doctor comes in the room and Beth, doctor says, Beth, do you have any questions? And Beth says, yeah, doctor, you know, this whole almost dying stuff, it's crazy. I don't want that to happen. What can I do? The doctor says, I have great news for you, Beth. Just don't eat peanuts. Now, here's the thing. She doesn't ever eat peanuts. She doesn't have to go to Peanuts Anonymous to stay away from peanuts. She doesn't have to work a 12-step program to stay away from peanuts. In fact, there's no Peanuts Anonymous anywhere in the world. Go check, Google it. See if you can find a Peanuts Anonymous. You won't find one. You know why? Because people with that type of abnormal physical reaction, they only have the allergy. They do not have the twist of the mind. If Beth had the twist of the mind, she's in trouble. She will die. Because as soon as the thing that would have caused a very quick and certain death, and her life is saved, she would go out, she'd head over to the nearest Walgreens, CVS, grocery store, 7-Eleven, and she'd pick up the very thing that was killing her, because she would have that obsession of the mind that would drive her back to the very thing that was killing her. And yet with us, we don't see it that way. Oh, Larry, that's different. See, you haven't accepted that you have both the allergy and the obsession, because you don't see yourself in that yet. You say, oh, no, this is different, because one, it's a slower death. My throat doesn't close up, Larry. But your physical manifestation is an intensification for the very thing that is killing you slowly. I know many people that have died of this disease. Some were priests. I know a rabbi. I mention those people because, as sad as it is, they had lovely and beautiful spiritual traditions, and they had a love of the higher power of their own understanding, and they knew more about spirituality and religion than I would ever know. And yet this disease took them out because they didn't understand that they needed to have a complete spiritual transformation as a result of the steps. They thought they were good, I'm presuming. They thought they were good with the God thing. They've been good since they were little children. You know, we agnostics, the chapter, don't worry about it, Larry. I got that covered. Let's get on to, tell me how this works, right? And so we have what we call confirmation bias in the psychology world. Confirmation bias is, you know, we form a strong belief in something, and then we look for supporting evidence of what our belief is. So, you know, if you believe that what you have is just, you fight for one more day, you've been in OA for 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, 30 years, 40 years, and it's been a fight most days, and that's your belief that what Overeaters Anonymous is going to meetings, sort of like, to use an AA term, put the plug in the jug and just sit down, take the cotton out of your, you know, out of your ears and put it in your mouth. Sit your butt, as I did in the back of the room before COVID, right? When we were meeting together, and just, or come on a Zoom meeting and just listen to, you know, get entertained a little bit, maybe take some notes, but you know that you're not going to take action because you may have a fear of success that maybe this higher power will do this on your behalf. And what will I become then? Or you're pretty certain that your history shows that this will never happen for you. And in either case, you will look for confirmation of that bias, and you will find it in droves in Overeaters Anonymous. You're well supported. So here's what the herd does in 12-step rooms. I use the herd term. That's probably most people. It's getting better, I think, but most people, I've been all over. And most people believe this is a fight each day. It's you discuss your problems. Maybe you do a 10-step. you dabble in the steps, you get a diet, you call your sponsor every day, or do what I did and sponsor yourself. That's what I'll do. Because, you know, I don't need a sponsor. There's a book. There's a, you know, give me the, I love when Weight Watchers, way before I came, they put everything on a point system online. Now I don't even need to see people. Oh, did that work for an isolator like me? I loved it, right? Just click and point and count my points and make a game of it. So many of us are that way. If you see yourself in that, me too, right? We like to isolate. We don't accept that this is a we program. And Zoom, for some of us, feed into that even more. Now I don't even need to see anybody, right? You know, but it's also had a silver lining. It's been good too in many ways. People that would have never walked in the rooms come, you know, and some will pick up the practical spiritual toolkit laid at their feet and work that program with a Sherpa, with someone in whom the problem has been solved, right? And here's the hope. You want to find a Sherpa who, you know, it's like if you were going to climb the Mount Everest and you have a group of people and you get to the mountain there and you've got this Sherpa, and this Sherpa says, okay, we're all ready. We got all the equipment. I've got all the maps. I have read every book. I've lived in this area my whole life. My dad has been to the top of that mountain. My uncle, many of my family members, there's not a square inch of this that I have not heard about. I'm feeling pretty good that I have a good Sherpa. Any questions? I feel bad. I ask a question. I say, I guess one, you know, when you were at the top of the mountain, oh, no. I've never been to the top of the mountain. I've never climbed it, but I have these maps and I've got this book and I know the book. I've memorized the maps. And if you hear me speak, you will know that I speak with authority. No, I know all that. I know all the equipment. Did I tell you about knowing all the equipment, all the tools that we need? Yeah, tell me that. But again, have you ever taken the steps and climbed that Mount Everest? No, I haven't done that. But again, back to the maps and the book and the memorization of everything and my uncle, and I know people that have. I don't want that Sherpa. I want someone to carry a lantern side by side with me that has walked and stumbled, that knows the pathway because they've taken it. They know it experientially. It's not a conceptual knowledge thing. They've done it. And the problem has been solved on their behalf. They took the steps, and the higher power of their own understanding effectuated the change. That's the woman or the man that I want. But the 9 sponsors that I had in the first 5 years in program, they were all lovely people. They all had wonderful intentions. Some of them probably had wonderful recovery. Some of them didn't, who knows. But I went for the celebrity sponsor too. I was going to manipulate and charm them and this and that and the other. But here's what I wasn't going to do. I wasn't going to trust in the process. I was going to have a sponsor so I could tell myself and tell others that, do you have a sponsor? Yes, indeed I do. But I was going to take what I wanted and leave the rest, which was most of the essential things, the hard things. Because after all, that's what you told me from day one. Take what you want and leave the rest. I'm leaving most of it. And particularly, here's what I'm leaving. Any of the stuff that makes me uncomfortable. So here's what makes me uncomfortable. Putting down the food. When I put down the food, they told me, my sponsor says, you've heard him say it. My sponsor says, when you put the food down entirely, you put the heroin substance down entirely, you're going to feel better. Oh, good. Thank goodness. Here's what you're going to feel better, Larry. You're going to feel anger better. You're going to feel fear better. You're going to feel like punching someone better. You're going to feel jealousy better. You're going to feel for the first time. And that's very uncomfortable for you and me, right? So you talk about emotional uncomfortability. It's going to take someone who really is desperate to be willing to go through that emotional uncomfortability of feeling for the first time. Now, some days you might not feel much not eating the food. We've gone on diets and we've had good days, but eventually the buildup of normal human emotion. And by the way, it's not always negative emotion. For me, I couldn't stand the extreme of positive emotion. Too many good feelings was too much. It was anxiety provoking for me. And I needed my, you know, I needed to kind of come down, and the food anesthetized me from whether it was positive emotion or zoning out with the negative emotions. Sometimes I needed to feel the anticipatory excitement. You know, I would order a pizza, right? By the way, in AA, they talk about food. I also go to AA. They talk about food. So that's crazy, like, in my opinion. I don't speak for OA or anybody in Milwaukee or anywhere. But don't talk about food. That's going to trigger me. Guess what? You're going to die anyway eating the food. You're going to eat the food whether I talk about it or not, if you're an untreated condition. And perhaps the most compassionate thing that I could do is just let you know the truth of that with love and compassion. You don't eat because I talk about pizza. Pizza, the person that's recovered, not cured, when I say recovered, the person who's recovered, it's in the big book. The person, when they refer to recovered, they just mean someone who's had a spiritual awakening, a transformation as the result of the steps, and they can go anywhere. They don't go to Dunkin' Donuts to gain a vicarious thrill, you know? But if they had to pick something up for family or something, they could do it and they're not bothered by it. Alcoholics that have had a spiritual awakening, they don't, maybe in the beginning you avoid things because you have not had a spiritual awakening. You're in the process of having that, which can happen very quickly. Okay, but so they avoid going to those places at that point. I'm not talking about that person. I'm talking about the person that in the promises, they say the problem has been solved. Those promises appear after the ninth step. You've completed the steps in sequence. Now you've had an effective, sustainable spiritual awakening, and you can go anywhere. You can, you know, the food will not call to you at that point. You still have a nose. You have eyes. I see the pizza. I can smell it. It just has no pull on me. When I was not in a recovered state, by the grace of God, I will say, the grace of my higher power, because I didn't deserve it, the obsession to eat was lifted. And I no longer had to run through the grocery store almost, avoiding looking at things for fear that they are going to have some sort of gravitational magic into my cart, and then the package will magically open by itself and the food will go down my gullet magically. See, I don't have that fear anymore. They don't give a coin out for the day that that happened. We count our days, we do, and that's great, we should. But I can't tell you the day that I didn't have to run through those different areas. You know them, in the grocery stores. I can't tell you the day that I had to avoid driving in certain areas because I'm passing all those wonderful places that used to pull my car in, you know, into the drive-through or the convenience stores. I can't tell you the particular day that happened, but it did happen. See, the God of my understanding did for me what I couldn't do for myself. So when we talk about hope, there's tremendous hope. This really works. The shortest sentence in the big book, it works. It really does. It works. It really does. I forgot which page. I don't have such a great memory. Might be 88 or so. I don't know. It works. It really does. If Harlan were on the phone and my sponsor, he'd tell you exactly the page. He's got one of those minds. He'd tell you exactly where it was. I don't know. But it does. It works. It really does. But you. When I advocate with the people that I sponsor, the men that I sponsor, I advocate working the steps quickly. Some, you may have heard the term, you know, like your hair's on fire. Now that seems so counterintuitive to me, working the steps quickly, isn't, especially as psychologists, don't we process trauma on a daily basis and peel away the layers of the onion and process that emotion and bring it up? And that could take years, months. It's sort of a psychoanalytic process. Isn't that what this is? No, it's not. This program, not for me, it's not. And not for the founders of the program. And not even for Roseanne, the founder of OA in 1960. She knew that this was about a spiritual transformation. Do you know Roseanne, whom I love, never knew? My sponsor knew her. My sponsor was at her deathbed. And he promised to keep carrying this message. You can ask him about that story. He was there. And she really, she told him, and I'm paraphrasing, you keep carrying this message for as long as you can. And when my sponsor tells me to keep carrying this message as long as I can, you know, that's a commitment because I don't know about you, but I didn't come to Overeaters Anonymous to become popular or somehow to become an Overeaters Anonymous. That's like being the head of your class in summer school. You know what I mean? Like that's not, you know, that was, I had other ambitions in life, right? Than to carry this message in Overeaters Anonymous. There was a time when I thought, you know, I don't want anyone to know I'm in Overeaters Anonymous. Are you kidding? And today I am grateful. I when someone says, you know, Larry, thank you for something, you know what I say? The same thing that this woman by the name of Leah M. said to me one time years ago when I first met her, and I couldn't believe this woman, what was coming out of her mouth that resonated with me. She just spoke, and she spoke the language of the heart, and she offered such beautiful hope. And I said, Leah, I said, I was in tears. I hugged her. I said, you have no idea. And she looked at me. She's a short little woman with a big family beyond her OA family. And she looked me in the eye, and she might not even remember this, but she said, Larry, thank you for noticing God's handiwork. Thank you for noticing God's handiwork. And that's what this is we, what do? You recover. And then for a lifetime, you carry the message. You continue to take your inventory in 10. You seek to enhance and expand your relationship with the higher power of your own understanding through prayer and meditation. And the Big Book gives some other suggestions upon awakening, retiring at night. And then you do all those things so that you're in fit spiritual condition, so you have a message to carry. I'm an imperfect man. There were someone online is like, yeah, we can see that. But I'm an imperfect person. And, you know, my sponsor told me, you know, Larry, after 20, he's been in program for 40 some years. And he said to me, 20 years in, he was a big shot. He had a case of big shotism. And he was like a keynote speaker. Here you go. He's a keynote speaker in LA at the OA birthday party some 20 years ago. And he's walking through the lobby, and everyone knows Harlan, and they want to know him, and, you know, different things. But he will be the first to tell you, you can ask him. He knew he had his hand in a cellophane bag during that time. He was no different than Roseanne. But we are littered with well-intentioned, beautiful people that this disease tackled them from behind. It tackled me from behind as well. And substances and behaviors that I never thought were an issue became an issue. They didn't seem to have a pull on me. This disease is very much like that whack-a-mole game. And next thing you know, why is that? Why would that be? Because the disease, the spiritual malady, the disease is progressive. He says, our recovery has to be equally or more progressive. So maybe you've heard, you know, the idea, it's like, you know, trying to climb up a down escalator as a kid. I hope none of the adults are doing that today. Of course, nobody's at a mall doing that nowadays, right? But you climb up an escalator going down, you better keep moving. Because if you don't keep moving, you're going to find yourself right back down. And that's what this is, that the reason that I do this today is because I have to. Not only because I owe, but because the disease is getting stronger. There are people on the line that will confirm that for you. They had recovery. They had lost the weight or gained the weight if they needed to do that. We have anorexic, bulimic people in our midst that also are compulsive eaters. We come in all shapes and sizes. You know, the thinnest person in the room isn't necessarily the healthiest, right? So, but once God's handiwork comes into play and we do the work, we row our boat, we chop our wood, to use kind of a Zen thing. We work the steps. No one's going to do that on my behalf. And we do it on a daily basis. We go through it in a formal way in the beginning to have an effective, sustainable spiritual awakening. But then we somehow, the obsession's lifted. But then there are people on this line that they just feel this feeling in their heart to carry the message. That's the other thing that your higher power does for you. All ideas, emotions, and attitudes which once dominated us, which once were the guiding force of who we were, are supplanted. They are replaced by new ideas, emotions, and attitudes, right? And that is an ongoing process. You know, that is not, there's no graduation, right? No graduation. If I invite you to my graduation, don't come. Because if I'm at that point where I'm saying, look, Mary Kay, you come to my graduation. I see you, Mary, and I've wanted you to come to my graduation, and we're going to hold it over at McDonald's there. And you come and we'll put out some different things. And maybe we'll supersize a few things along the way. Don't come to my graduation, Mary. Right now, there is no graduation, right? What this is a lifetime, and oh, the places you will go and the people you will meet and the things you will do that you didn't think you were capable of doing. And it's really, really tremendous to experience that. I did not set out. This was not my plan for this to become such an important part of my life. But I think that's what my higher power intended, you know, was for me to basically to stay sober. You're helping me. Have you ever called someone, they're like, well, thank you for helping me? And I remember one of my sponsors who had been sober for so many years and offered such beautiful hope. And he took me, he was the first one to crack open the big book, right? And I'm looking for my big book. And he opened it up to the first page. I don't read the preface. Never read the preface before. The table of contents we read. He even read the story of how many thousands of men and women have what? Recovered. How dare someone say they're recovered? What are you, some big shot, Larry? Recovered? Are you all full of yourself there? You're recovered, you're cured, how dare you? No, that's God's handiwork. It's as though to use a bad analogy, my cancer is still there, but it's in remission by the grace of God. And as long as I continue to work these steps imperfectly, and I try to, you know, the altruistic movement that was started, Reverend Sam Shoemaker, it's not even my religious tradition I was born into, but he talked about the altruistic movement. You know, he talked about there were four, Barbara can tell you, I see you there, Barbara. I love your background, Barbara. She'll tell you, but ask Barbara about the four impediments to recovery, the four impediments to accessing power. She'll tell you that, you know, there's perhaps a resentment we will not let go of, right? A secret we will not tell. Oh, I had many secrets. I told you most of them. I told one to Barbara and one over here and the guy down the street. No one ever got the entire story. And then I always had some secrets that I was going to take to my grave. So resentment I won't let go of, had those. A secret I will not tell. A vicarious thrill I will not stop. What do you mean? Vicarious thrill, manipulation, dishonesty. You know, could be some of those vicarious thrills. I will not stop. And then an amend I will not make. And Reverend Sam Shoemaker said that those are the four things. This had, you know, he influenced Bill W., and it made its way into the foundation of our recovery. It made its way into the text, and Roseanne and these other beautiful women that started OA in LA in 1959 and 60 and so forth, and Dolores and all these other people, they knew that this was a spiritual program of action, taking action after action after action, speaking the language of the heart, which sometimes troubles people. Because it's not, you know, we will hold your hand in OA and we'll nurture you and we'll walk you and we'll walk you hand in hand to your grave. We'll be at your graveside. Sometimes that's not so compassionate. There can be well-intentioned, beautiful, lovely people that are there to support you, but that's not necessarily compassion to me. Sometimes compassion is telling the truth, saying what you mean, but not saying it mean. You know, I don't come here to offend. I'm a pleaser by nature. I want you to like me. Jennifer, I want you to like me. I want you to go away and feel, oh, there is a good guy. But if I disturb someone, maybe all to the good, the big book tells me that maybe it's all to the good, that I couldn't stay stopped, that I wasn't working a program of spiritual action. Or like Harlan says that, you know, as he's walking down like a celebrity 20 years ago, but he knows he's eating Doritos, he says death by Dorito. And he had to go back into the steps and the humility. You know, I'm speaking here, you know, and I have not picked up food by the grace of God. I have not picked up any of my alcoholic food substances. As far as I know, there could be a new one that comes up. But there's been other things that have plagued me at times, you know, and I'll tell you, and that'll resonate with one or two people on the line, you know. So, but I don't want to be a statistic of someone that, like whack-a-mole, it pops up in another area, you know. Because remember, I was telling you about Beth. Beth is she's finishing up her bachelor in fine arts in theater. She studied in Paris. Theater and film and all this stuff. I'm bragging. I know. Sorry, Barbara. I'm bragging. I'm a proud papa, you know. And she's her own woman. She's a young woman, you know. But here's why I bring her up as my only child, because, as I said, she doesn't know the man that her mom knew when we divorced, you know, over 20 years ago. I'm not that man. I am not that same man. Not because Larry controlled all this. Larry changed because Larry wanted to change and Larry effectuated a change. Oh no. See, my higher power did the changing. My higher power did the heavy lifting. I am not minimizing the necessity and the hard work that we all have to do, that the hope lies in that, right? But I have to give credit to where credit is due. I am not a religious person. I really value, you know, all different religious traditions. I am certainly not an atheist. I'm still perhaps more of the agnostic variety in that. What I'm saying is in that I was born into a religious tradition, but my relationship to higher power is three things today that it never was before. The God of my understanding, the higher power of my understanding is one that is personal to me. Personal. I wasn't raised in a home where it was personal. That was a detached, distant sort of, you know, higher power. I needed a new conception. It wasn't blasphemy in that I'm creating the new religion. No, no, no. It was just that I was the moving target and I had to get a bigger vision, a bigger hopeful vision that this higher power in which bad things happen to good people in this world, that I don't understand. And my time's gone. Thank you, Lisa. Bad things happen to good people, but I had to conceive of a higher power that could help me to transcend those things. Right. And so I needed that. So I don't know, Lisa, but we're going to open it up to a Q&A, I believe. I thank you for letting me. I don't know if I said anything that helped you. Maybe we lost everybody, but I'm really grateful that you allowed me to do it anyway. With that, I pass.